Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Jean Renoir, the humanist of the screen. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 16 minutes. Jean Renoir. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants. We ended our first block with a camera that learned to breathe. Today we meet the director who taught it to listen. If Griffith gave narrative film its grammar and Eisenstein gave editing its dialectics, Jean Renoir gave the movies a civic temperament, an art of staging where a camera moves as graciously as a host, where rooms stay open to the unexpected, where characters are never reduced to a single angle because the lens keeps discovering them from another. His films do not shout their innovations. They behave differently. They let depth hold meaning. They let a doorway carry an ethic. They let a pan feel like a change of mind. And through that gentle audacity, they remake how you and I believe space, time, and neighborliness work on screen. He was born into pictures before cinema existed. His father, Pierre-Auguste Renoir, brushed light onto canvas until it behaved like warmth. The child Jean grew up among models and fruit bowls, in a house where a chair was never just furniture but an invitation, where a window made a promise to the eye and a promise had to be kept. You can feel that apprenticeship in the way he composes later. Bodies are placed the way a painter arranges color fields, not to impress but to harmonize. A lamp is not a prop but a sentence. A door opens with moral consequence. He tried other lives, war, wounds, recovery, ceramic enterprises, and drifted toward film with the stubbornness of someone who discovers that the only way to thank life for sparing him is to make something honest. The early silent features, often dismissed as practice, already show the habit that will become his signature. In La Fille de l'Eau and Nana, he plays with movement like a musician finding a key. He cuts less than his peers do because he prefers to leave the witness on the stand, to let an action unfold inside one frame and ask the viewer to look, not be dragged. Then sound arrives, and where many directors staple dialogue to image like a label, he treats sound as air. La Chien speaks plainly without fuss. The camera sidles, not to show off but to give actors room. A pan that begins on a gesture ends on the truth the gesture hides. You realize watching him that fluid camera is not a trick, it is a form of courtesy. It spares the viewer whiplash and spares the actor interruption. Renoir is misremembered as a poet of mildness. There is steel in his kindness. Boudou Saved from Drowning begins with a man plucked from a river by bourgeois benevolence. What follows is not a lesson in gratitude but an autopsy of condescension. The camera refuses to trap Boudou in a single frame. It gives him the same elaboration of space that it grants the benefactor's salon. When Boudou shambles through that salon like weather through a parlor, the staging doesn't scold, it demonstrates. A pan across seated propriety keeps landing on the thing propriety cannot absorb. His appetite, his sleep, his freedom from piety. The joke is not at Boudou's expense or at the household's alone. It is on the fragile fantasy that order is a moral argument. He likes to place a window in a scene and let life pass outside it while talk continues inside, so that the film becomes a conversation between rooms. In La Chienne, an apartment's shabby window opens onto a street that does not care. The angle says it without speech. This love is being performed in a theater that has not sold enough tickets. In Party de Campagne, a picnic begins as flirtation and turns into the kind of ache that outlives marriages. Wind lifts hair, trees bow, clouds hurry, the river pretends to be innocent. He films the afternoon as if time itself were the third conspirator. No sermon, just weather deciding a life. The short remained unfinished for years. It carries the beauty of the unfinished honestly, like a melody interrupted by rain. The camera's movements are as delicate as a hand that does not want to alter what it touches. He travels to the South and makes Tony, a film that European critics will later claim as a godparent of Italian neorealism. Location shooting, non-actors, a story small enough to be none of your business until it is. He does not use poverty as decoration. He uses it as scale. A train yard and a quarry are not backdrops. They are reasons why people talk as they do and surrender as they must. The lens stays patient. It lets quarrels travel the length of a room. It lets work be work. Renoir is teaching the movies to stop pushing and start noticing. He refuses the impulse to cover every exchange with close UPS. Instead, he builds a frame that can hold disagreement without making either party a stranger. Then comes the film that soldiers wrote about from the front, because it gave them a decent way to name what they had discovered among enemies. La Grande Illusion. When you say the title aloud, it often sounds like a thesis. The film is a room. Captivity and class are its furniture. A French aristocrat pilot and a German aristocrat commandant recognize one another as cousins. Education, posture, the long indoctrination of privilege, and Renoir stages their recognition in depth. Foreground men joke, midground soldiers barter, background figures carry chairs, and across those plains, a glance travels like a letter. He is not proving an argument about the end of aristocracy. He is letting you watch a cast's last coherent conversation. His lens doesn't flatter. It does not indict. Remembers? And it refuses to permit the camera to simplify any man to uniform or accent. Deep staging before deep focus is what he is working with. The lenses of the 1930s rarely kept every plane sharp, but the director's blocking maintains meaning across depth regardless of blur. Jean Gabin in the foreground, Eric von Stroheim set back, a door admitting the cold, your eyes travel not because cutting orders them to, but because lines of attention have been drawn like roads. When a character turns, the camera often reframes lightly, as if acknowledging that a person's thought deserves a small accommodation. Bazin later made theory out of this, praising Renoir's democracy of space, but on set it was a method, stage the scene so the camera can stay honest. La Bête Humaine is proof that he can drive a locomotive and the human engine at the same time. Trains cut across frames like the logic of fate. Gabin's face is a cloud bank that rarely clears. The tracks belong to schedules, but the camera refuses to. A murder occurs not as a climax but as an oscillation, the way a life keeps returning to a bad impulse. Renoir's discipline here is to make melodrama feel like weather again. He knows the genre storms, but he never lets lightning become immoral. It remains a force you must read and shelter from. Then La Règle du jeu, the film that flopped, that censors trimmed, that historians resurrected, that filmmakers study the way musicians study Bach. Everyone has their reasons, says Octave, Renoir's own role, and the movie walks that sentence into every room. A country house becomes a chessboard where desire, rank, boredom, and generosity collide. He designs scenes as ecosystems. A hunt cutting to a kitchen, a salon chant drifting to servants' quarters, a movement of lovers seen through doors in reflections behind railings on balconies. You can pause anywhere and discover a subdrama alive without permission. A maid glancing, a butler deciding not to see, a guest yawning as if yawns were polite applause. The camera's movements are graceful until grace becomes diagnosis. When the lens sweeps and cannot find a place to rest, you feel a civilization out of breath. People call the film prophetic. It is an autopsy that pities the body. Beneath wit and farce, farce done at master level, doors opening in time like percussion. There is the director's refusal to condense a person to their worst moment. Even the cad gets his angle. Even the generous betray themselves when the social weather drops. Renoir's staging in depth and in ensemble is not a style, it is a restraint. He denies himself the editor's license to declare. He prefers to let the room declare itself over minutes. The result is a film in which tragedy arrives as an administrative error. Employees and employers cannot see each other as human until it is too late. War ruptures the gallery. Renoir leaves. In America, he tests what migrates. Swamp Water and The Southerner are films Americans sometimes call regional, as if region were a diminishment instead of the only way lives are actually lived. He puts the camera at knee height to let you feel mud. He uses light not as glamour but as temperature. He promises that a porch can carry a philosophy if you let a conversation finish. In The Woman on the Beach, trauma mangles seeing. He stages blindness as a habit of mind that affects the sighted first. RKO wanted a thriller. Renoir turned in The Diary of a Wounded Gaze. Studio hands recut. The film survives like a bird with one wing. He goes back to Europe through Italy and then through the door marked color. The River, shot in India, uses Technicolor the way his father used pigment, to persuade sunshine to mean. He does not exoticize. He watches. A child dies and the world does not. Rituals occur without explanation, because explanation would be a form of conquest. The camera maintains the Renoir courtesy. It adapts to the subject instead of asking the subject to perform. Satyajit Ray, then a young designer, found work on the production and later said the encounter taught him that films could be made from the lives he knew. That influence alone, like a tributary feeding a river, would be an adequate reason to keep Renoir in any canon. But stay with the film on its own terms. It keeps color from becoming indulgent by tying each hue to a daily act. Saris are not spectacle, they are how bodies move. The Ganges is not a symbol, it is a schedule. Girls climb trees not as metaphor but because the tree is a place. Late works, The Golden Coach, French Cancan, Elena et les Hommes, return to theater and pageant without giving up that courtesy. The frame becomes a proscenium that breathes. Costumes teach posture. Music teaches timing. The theater is the world, says a character. Renoir agrees only if the theater is porous. In French Cancan, the canvas of dance is so alive with off-center action that you begin to feel, or remember, that collective joy is a moral good. The camera never sneers at spectacle. It requests honesty from it. When extras become chorus and chorus becomes city, you can feel him smiling at what collaboration can do when nobody pretends to be more important than their square of floor. What, besides the warmth people mention when they say Renoir, does he invent that you can use? Start with staging in depth as a moral instrument. When you stage a meeting in one plane, power tends to polarize, speaker and spoken to. When you stage it in depth, power acquires context. A clerk passing behind, a window showing weather that makes everyone smaller, a rival entering from the rear. Depth staging refuses the simplistic duel and encourages the viewer to weight conflicting claims. It trains the audience's conscience by making it busy. Add reframing as thought. His pans are not tours. They are decisions. When a character's feeling shifts, the camera drifts with it rather than cutting to announce that the revelation has arrived. This soft pivot, repeated across a film, replaces lecture with companionship. You can translate that into any medium. Instead of trumpeting a conclusion, turn toward it and let the reader walk the distance with you. Add ensemble as truth. He is almost never content to show you a hero doing something while the world pauses. He prefers the orchestra. That choice makes his movies feel truer because most of our lives occur in contexts that do not freeze for us. When you build a scene that contains the next room and the corridor sound and the glance that does not know it is being filmed, you respect reality. You also give an actor the gift of being looked at without being devoured. Add doors and windows as ethics. A door closed in Renoir is seldom melodramatic. It is administrative. Someone who might have been included is not. A window seen through says the inside is willing to measure itself against the outside. A window used as a mirror says the inside has begun to believe itself the world. Watch Rules of the Game again with only doors in mind and see how your analysis changes. Doors used to hide, to protect, to pretend, to collide. Add above all the refusal to simplify. Everyone has their reasons, is not an alibi. It is a working premise that asks you to find the reason before you pass sentence. Renoir's method enacts that premise. Keep the shot long enough to reveal motive. Keep the space porous enough to admit surprise. Keep your actors free enough to invent within the plan. Allow error to be folded into the fabric. When the hunting party in Rules drifts from farce into slaughter, he cuts more rapidly not to excite but to accuse. The rhythm itself says, "You did not mean this, your habits produced it." His is moral filmmaking by means of attention. People often place Renoir in the past, the way they place a kind relative in a family album. But every time you admire a modern film's unbroken scene because it allowed an argument to flower, every time you feel a director's compassion in the refusal to mock even a fool, every time a camera slides 3 feet so that the other becomes present, you are in his school. The opposite is also instructive. When a scene cuts you into a corner and makes you loathe a character you have not had time to meet, imagine Renoir like a hand on your elbow saying, "Stay a second longer, see if contempt still feels intelligent." He had enemies and accidents and studio cuts. He had, late in life, the joy of looking back without bitterness. Interviews from those years project a calm seldom granted to directors who have touched greatness. The calm was learned. He made films that failed among their contemporaries and triumphed later. He made films that pleased then and now feel like exercises. He kept making because making kept him honest. The craft he bequeaths is airy and demanding. It asks you to understand that a camera angle is a stance toward a person. That a dolly is a promise to the actor that your lens will work as hard as they do, that to make a frame is, finally, to vote for generosity or for convenience. He votes for generosity again and again, and his films remain young because generosity is never contemporary, it is perennial. Bring him close to your day and the instructions become homely. When you lead a meeting, resist turning it into two chairs facing. Arrange the room in depth. Let the juniors sit where their presence can alter the geometry. When you tell a story, resist the temptation to cut to the conclusion. Pivot, carry the listener with you. When you have the power to exclude, treat the door as a decision you will have to defend later to someone you respect. When you are tempted to simplify arrival, grant them one extra beat in your mind and see what arrives. These are not metaphors. They are Renoir's method translated to the work of any daylight. He died in Beverly Hills in 1979, the son of a painter who had become the painter of rooms full of people who do not yet know how much they owe one another. His films are frequently described as humanist. The word is used so often it risks becoming a label for overcast afternoons. Keep it sharp. In Renoir, humanism means technique put in the service of fairness. The long take is patience, the deep frame is context, the moving camera as attention, the ensemble as humility. Put that way, the style is not style at all. It is conduct. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants.